Swing into Seaside Golf in Ocean City, Maryland. Play like a pro at 17 championship courses designed by golf legends like Jack Nicklaus and Arthur Hills. Tee off on sweeping vistas at Eagle's Landing. Savor the coastal views of Lighthouse Sound. Or see why Ocean City Golf Club is considered one of the Mid-Atlantic's finest fairways. Whether you're sneaking in a quick round on a family vacation or going all in on a golf getaway, fun is always in play at Ocean City, Maryland. Plan your trip at OCOcean.com.
If it's Monday, what's next for Republicans after former President Trump publicly calls for terminating the Constitution to make him president again? We'll speak with a top Republican urging the party to dump Trump over those comments, his own former national security advisor. Plus, it's the final day of campaigning in the Georgia runoff as Democrats try to hang on to a key Senate seat and Republicans try to fend off another allegation of misconduct against their candidate. NBC's exclusive reporting ahead. And an Iranian government official says the nation's morality police has been abolished. Is that true? The future of freedom and women's rights in Iran are at stake as protests there continue. Welcome to Meet the Press Now. I'm Kristen Welker. We begin today with the very latest controversial comment by former President Trump, as Republicans once again must deal with arguably dangerous rhetoric from their past and potentially future presidential standard bearer. While repeating his false claims about the 2020 election, Mr. Trump posted on his social media website, quote, "A massive fraud of this type and magnitude allows for the termination of all rules, regulations, and articles, even those found in the Constitution." Mr. Trump seemingly tried to clarify that statement today amid pushback, but he then doubled down on demands that he be made president, which would require the termination of the Constitution. We've not yet heard from most top Republicans about the former president's call to terminate the Constitution, but we have seen some condemnation from the rank and file.
The Constitution is set for a reason. To protect the rights of every American. And so I certainly don't endorse that language or that sentiment.
I vehemently disagree with the statement that Trump has made. Trump has made, you know, 1,000 statements in which I disagree.
I think that, like this.
Absolutely. And I believe, answering your question, that people certainly are going to take into consideration a statement like this as they evaluate a candidate.
In just a moment, I will speak with another Republican who is speaking out, former Trump National Security Advisor John Bolton. But as has been the case in many past episodes with former President Trump, some Republicans are unwilling to distance themselves too much from him. Take a listen to Ohio Republican Congressman David Joyce.
Can you support a candidate in 2024 who's for suspending the Constitution?
Well, again, it's early. I think there's going to be a lot of people in the primary. I think at the end of the day, you will say whoever the Republicans end up pick, I'll fall in behind because that's...
Even if it's Donald Trump and he's called for suspending the Constitution?
Well, again, I think it's going to be a big field. I don't think Donald Trump's going to clear out the field like he did in the 16.
That's not what I'm asking. I'm asking you, if he's the nominee, will you support him?
I will support whoever the Republican nominee is.
That's a remarkable statement. You'd support a candidate who's come out for suspending the Constitution?
Well, you know, he says a lot of things. You have to take him in context.
But that's an extraordinary statement. You can't come out against someone who's for suspending the Constitution?
Well, first off, he has no ability to suspend the Constitution. Secondly,
but he says he's for it.
Well, you know, he says a lot of things that, but that doesn't mean that it's ever going to happen. So you got to accept exact fact from fantasy. And fantasy is that we're going to suspend the Constitution and go backwards. We're moving forward.
Republicans have been here before, from the 2016 primary to the Trump presidency and even just a few days ago, after it was revealed that he had a dinner with outspoken anti-Semite Ye, the artist formerly known as Kanye West, and known white supremacist Nick Fuentes. The questions we keep coming back to are still as relevant today as they've always been. Is there a final breaking point for Republicans with Mr. Trump? And if there isn't, what do these next 2 years look like? Joining me now is NBC's Garrett Hake. He's been covering the Trump campaign and the Republican Party's reaction to it so far. So, Garrett, you heard that criticism there by some Republicans. We have not yet heard from Mitch McConnell. We have not yet heard from Kevin McCarthy. What is the broader reaction, and is there pressure on the Republican leadership to speak out?
Kristen, there are 701 days left until Election Day in 2024, and Republican leaders are going to be counting every one of them at this rate. We're now 3 weeks into a Trump campaign. Two of those weeks have started with Republican leaders trying to avoid answering questions about Donald Trump. I asked Mitch McConnell myself in this hallway just about an hour ago to comment on this latest affront from Donald Trump against the Constitution. He did not do so. Kevin McCarthy has not done so. I have heard from some Republican members just the beginnings of criticism of these comments, and they follow a familiar pattern. Both Roy Blunt, who's a member of leadership who I just spoke to, and Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mike Rounds, Republican senators, have put out statements online condemning the comments but not condemning Donald Trump by name. Republicans are condemning Donald Trump as though they're worried he has a Google alert for his own name and will see it and respond to them. That has always been the concern among Republicans, that any condemnation of the former president, the person, as opposed to perhaps a narrow set of actions, will draw his wrath and his ire. Now, for Lisa Murkowski, she just survived a round of Donald Trump's wrath, a Donald Trump-backed and funded primary challenger who was not enough to defeat her. You would think we'd be far enough from the next election that perhaps some of these Republicans who would like to see a different leader going forward would speak out more forcefully. So far, none have.
We saw a real split when it came to the reaction from McConnell and McCarthy in response to that dinner with Ye, the artist formerly known as Kanye West, and the white supremacist. Do you expect, Garrett, once we hear from Republican leadership, that we will see that type of divide again? Or what are you anticipating?
I think we may. Now, we did ultimately late last week hear a much stronger stance from McCarthy on Ye after his kind of stepped up his anti-Semitic comments on that InfoWars radio show. But the divide between these two leaders goes back several years over how to handle Trump. And it's pretty simple. Mitch McConnell doesn't need Donald Trump for anything. He has just been reelected the party leader of the Senate Republicans. His leadership there is largely unchallenged, except for that kind of momentary push from Rick Scott in these last leadership elections. Kevin McCarthy still needs Donald Trump a great deal if he's going to succeed in claiming the Speaker's gavel come January. He cannot afford to irritate him, and his members, generally speaking, view Donald Trump much more favorably. That, you know, right now there's only one senator who's endorsed Donald Trump. There's more than a dozen House members who've done so. McCarthy feels as though politically, internally, he's got to walk a much more complicated line here than does McConnell. And we see that in their actions as regards the former president every day. That said, Mitch McConnell had every opportunity last week to condemn the former president more forcefully or say he wouldn't support him if he were the 2024 nominee. He didn't do so.
Yeah, two very different political realities that they are dealing with. Garrett Haake, thank you for your great reporting, as always. In addition to lawmakers, former President Trump is also facing criticism over his comments from his own former administration officials. Trump National Security Advisor John Bolton tweeted Saturday, quote, "No American conservative can agree with Donald Trump's call to suspend the Constitution because of the results of the 2020 election, and all real conservatives must oppose his 2024 campaign for president." And with me now is former National Security Advisor and former ambassador to the UN, John Bolton. Ambassador Bolton, it's so good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Glad to be here.
Let's start with your reaction and just following up on your tweet. We have been here so many times before, but does this moment feel different for you when it comes to former President Trump, who's now a declared candidate?
Well, this is an existential threat to the Republic itself. He has said that he wants the Constitution terminated. Now, he's tried to walk it back today, but he failed. The only people who can understand that are people who don't speak English. He's saying the same things in slightly different words. It's not merely wrong and outrageous. It is disqualifying. A president, when he's sworn into office, takes a constitutional oath that says in part, "I will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution." Donald Trump has just said he won't do that. That is disqualifying, and Republican leaders have to say that.
So just to follow up with you, what is your message to McConnell and McCarthy? We haven't heard from them yet.
Well, I think this is more than simply saying we want to uphold the Constitution. Donald Trump, if he were to take the oath of office again, God forbid, would either be lying about preserving, protecting, and defending the Constitution, or maybe he wouldn't say it at all. You can't have this kind of approach. It's not something one can disagree with. This is foundational to the republic. And we've got a lot of leadership things coming up here, the chairmanship of the Republican National Committee. We've got perhaps a dozen or more prospective presidential candidates looking to 2024. I think every one of them, before they declare their candidacy, should say Donald Trump was wrong, we repudiate him, he doesn't belong in the Republican Party. And honestly, if they don't, there's one thing that would get me to get into the presidential race, which I look at in prior elections, it would be to make it clear to the people of this country that Donald Trump is unacceptable as the Republican nominee.
So let me follow up with you because you've just made some news there. You are essentially telling us that you would consider getting into the 2024 race.
Absolutely. I think to be a presidential candidate, you can't simply say, I support the Constitution. You have to say, I would oppose people who would undercut it. You know, we used to have a thing in the House of Representatives called the House Un-American Affairs Committee. I think when you challenge the Constitution itself the way Trump has done, that is un-American.
Let's stay here for a moment. Just walk me through your thinking. What does your timeline look like? What would cause you to cross into saying what you're saying now and actually being a declared candidate for president?
Look, all of the potential candidates know what Trump has said. This is no secret to anybody. I don't see why they aren't saying it right now. I think the voters, the Republican voters, people who choose the Republican nominee, nearly 95% disagree that Donald Trump is more important than the Constitution. I'm afraid there are some who would stick with Trump on this. What does a candidate have to lose by appealing to 95% of the base of the Republican Party? I actually think most Republican elected officials in Washington disagree with Trump on this, but they're intimidated. This is the time where there's strength in numbers. The more people who tell the truth, the easier it is for everybody else.
So what do you have to see that would make you say, now is the moment that I am going to declare my candidacy?
I'd like to see Sherman-esque statements from all the potential candidates. If I don't see that, then I'm going to seriously consider getting in.
And what is your timeline, Ambassador Bolton?
Well, I think it's going to have to be pretty short. We've already got one declared candidate for president in the Republican Party who doesn't believe in the Constitution. This is serious business.
You look at a Ron DeSantis. He just had an incredibly strong win for reelection in Florida. If you got into the race with a former President Trump and a Ron DeSantis, do you think you would stand a chance in that race, in that matchup?
Well, I don't know. I think the point here would be to stress that Republicans do support the Constitution and the former president notwithstanding. But I'll also say this. I think the 2024 presidential election is going to be a lot more about national security and the threats to the United States that we've seen before. I think it's important to make those points. And I think within the Republican Party, the isolationist virus that Trump has let loose needs to be addressed as well. So there'll be plenty of things to talk about.
So, and let me try to pin you down on that. What would your platform be? What would your message to voters be about why you are running? Would it purely be to stop Trump, or is it broader than that?
Well, I think to stop some of the things Trump has done to the party. Trump's a whiner. He's negative. He's the most persecuted American out there. This is 180 degrees opposite from Ronald Reagan, for whom it was mourning in America, who was optimistic, who believed in the country, believed in its strength. And I think that is a positive message for Americans on domestic issues as well as foreign policy issues.
So what would an Ambassador John Bolton's platform be?
Well, I think it would be very Reagan-esque. I think certainly in foreign policy, it would be a peace through strength approach. That's what Ronald Reagan followed, and it succeeded in bringing down the Soviet Union. And I remain true to free market principles. I am not a social conservative. I think I'm actually pretty libertarian in that sense. And I think that's what the country wants to get the economy moving again.
One of the interesting things that we saw in 2016 was that there were so many candidates in the Republican field that it splintered the vote, and that effectively allowed Mr. Trump to win the nomination. Would you have any concerns that if you entered the race that you would allow that to happen and actually embolden him?
No, I think there are a lot of candidates already. I think it's a serious analysis. It was a problem in 2016. I think the winnowing process this time is going to be more rigorous than it was in 2016. And I think Trump's base is small and getting smaller every day. I think one message people need to understand is that Donald Trump is the Democratic Party's best asset. To the extent Trump prospers within the Republican Party, it benefits Democrats. That's what I think we learned on November the 8th this year.
Mm. I want to try to just understand your timeline a little bit more. And I asked President Biden about this. When is he going to make that decision? He said he's going to sit down with his family, consult with them over the holidays. I wonder if you say you want to make this decision soon. Have you pinpointed a specific timeline? Will it be early in the new year? When can we expect to hear a final decision from you?
Well, I'd like to see what the other prospective candidates do. I think it's going to be a very crowded field. It doesn't benefit a political outsider like myself to wait around. So it might be earlier than some would think.
Okay. And I do want to just follow up with you, because when you talk about Trump's base, our latest NBC News poll shows 30% consider themselves more supporter of the former president, not of the party. What do you make of that number?
Well, that number has been going down. I've been doing my own polling. I think Trump's base within the party is really only about 15%. I think there are others who support him. I think there's kind of a knee-jerk reaction when he's paired against Joe Biden. But I think this comment on the Constitution, if voters were asked, do you prefer Donald Trump or the Constitution, what would the answer be? And that's the point that needs to be driven home. This man cannot be trusted alone in a room with the Constitution.
I want to move on to foreign policy. Before I do, though, I do want to just get your reaction to the latest developments in the Mar-a-Lago investigation. Given that you know more about classified material than most people, what do you make of the investigation into how those classified documents were handled at Mar-a-Lago? Do you expect that former President Trump will be indicted?
I think there's a substantial possibility. I can only say, if I had taken 320 or more classified documents with me when I left the White House, I would be in jail right now. And I think the recent 11th Circuit decision is very important on the point in rejecting the district court order of a special magistrate that said there is no separate rule for a former president. One law applies to everybody. And if the prosecutors in court stick with that, Trump is in real trouble.
Okay, let's talk about foreign policy. Let's talk about Iran, an issue, obviously, that you were quite engaged in your time in office. The Washington Post published a piece just last week about an increase in the tempo of assassinations and kidnapping plots by the Iranian government. You obviously have been targeted by Iran, so you know this personally. How alarmed are you by these reports?
Well, I think what the Iranian government is doing now is going after Iranian dissidents out in the diaspora in Europe and the United States. I think it's a sign they're very nervous. I think news that's come out in the past 24 hours that maybe the morality police have been suspended and the hijab rule is being reviewed, I think that's a mark of their concern. I don't necessarily think that reporting is right. I think this could be disinformation. It could be bait and switch. It could be a way to try and mollify the dissidents. The regime is under a greater threat today than at any point since it came to power in 1979.
Let's go back to the morality police. You are clearly skeptical. But what should we take from that reporting? You're saying that the Iranian government, as you just laid out, is on its heels, basically. But do you have any sense, is there any possibility that there's a shred of truth to that? Or do you dismiss the entire reporting around that?
Well, I don't think we know enough. It's one person has spoken out. The Islamic Republic Broadcasting Service has repudiated it. We really don't know at this point. But let's be clear. What these demonstrations led by the women of Iran have shown is not opposition to a dress code. This is an assault on the ideological legitimacy of the regime itself, on top of several years of enormous economic discontent. I think the regime has to worry that there would be fragmenting at the top.
So I asked you this about this moment in our country. Let me ask you, as it pertains to Iran, is this moment different? Do you expect there to be change, potentially regime change in this moment?
I think it's very possible. I can't say it's going to happen immediately.
How would it happen, Ambassador Bolton? What would the actual method be, do you think, if that were to happen?
The most likely is that the regular army and the Revolutionary Guard would fragment over this controversy. And there's something here that's very important to understand. All these top generals, all these top officials, all have mothers. Most have wives, sisters, daughters. They're all hearing the same thing. So it is far more dangerous to the regime than anything they've ever seen before.
We have seen very strong words come from the Biden administration. We've seen it ramped up sanctions. How would you assess how the Biden administration has responded so far?
Inadequately. The sanctions have not been ramped up significantly. The administration is still obsessed with trying to get back into the nuclear deal. I think we should be going to opposition figures and saying, how can we help? Communications equipment. What else can we do? It should be the clear policy of the United States to overthrow the Ayatollahs. That's the only way we're going to solve the nuclear problem.
And I know that you're opposed to the nuclear talks. There's reporting that Iran may be able to build crude nukes within 6 months. The administration would argue that getting a deal is the best shot at stopping Iran from doing that.
It's delusional. It was delusional in 2015. The deal itself facilitates Iran getting nuclear weapons. You cannot discount the potential cooperation between Iran and North Korea. The regime needs to go. That's how to keep Iran from going nuclear.
In 2015, you wrote an op-ed arguing that the only way to stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon is by taking military action. Do you still stand by that? Do you go so far as to call for nuclear action in this moment?
If you can't get regime change, then I think that is the only other option. I think that's where Bibi Netanyahu is in Israel. And you should ask yourself this question. Do you want a bunch of religious fanatics to have nuclear weapons that could destroy Israel and harm the United States? My tolerance for that risk is zero.
Okay, let's talk about Ukraine with our remaining time. You have met Vladimir Putin. How do you assess this moment? Because he has suffered some big losses, too, on the battlefield. There are concerns, as you know, as you've been asked about, that he would resort to the use of nuclear weapons. Do you think President Biden should sit down and talk to him face to face and try to help broker an end to this war?
No, absolutely not. And I think the signs we've seen from Macron and Schultz, Macron of France, Schultz of Germany, just in the past few days, have given Putin a sense of real optimism that the Europeans are beginning to fold. I think right now Putin sees little chance in the near term of victory on the battlefield. He's going to try and crack Western resolve and see if the Europeans, threatened with a cold winter, might be amenable to a political solution. This is not the time to negotiate with Putin.
How does this end then, Ambassador Bolton? Because you have President Zelensky saying he's not going to sit down at the negotiating table unless Russia pulls out of Ukraine. That doesn't seem realistic. So how do you think this conflict that has cost so many lives and so much suffering can be brought to an end?
Well, the Prime Minister of Finland was asked that question a few weeks ago, and she said, how does it end? It ends when Russian troops leave Ukraine. That's how it ends.
Very quickly, you have some Republicans saying, including Leader McCarthy, that they are not prepared to write a blank check to Ukraine. Your message to Republicans, do you agree with that assessment, or do you think that the U.S. should continue to keep its funding up to the level that it's been?
No, nobody's asking for a blank check. This benefits the United States. We're not helping the Ukrainians as an act of charity. We're doing it because it's in the best interest of the United States.
So you disagree with that message by McCarthy?
No, nobody's asking for a blank check. I wouldn't say that. I'd say we support Ukraine.
Ambassador Bolton, we covered a lot of ground. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Really appreciate the conversation. And coming up, we are just hours away from Election Day in Georgia's Senate runoff. Steve Kornacki is at the big board breaking down what to watch, plus new reporting on a new allegation against Herschel Walker, and later the future of the GOP leadership. Plus, the panel weighs in on what we just heard from Ambassador Bolton as tensions simmer in the Republican Party. Stay with us. You're watching Meet the Press now.
Swing into Seaside Golf in Ocean City, Maryland. Play like a pro at 17 championship courses designed by golf legends like Jack Nicklaus and Arthur Hills. Tee off on sweeping vistas at Eagle's Landing. Savor the coastal views of Lighthouse Sound. Or see why Ocean City Golf Club is considered one of the Mid-Atlantic's finest fairways. Whether you're sneaking in a quick round on a family vacation or going all in on a golf getaway, fun is always in play at Ocean City, Maryland. Plan your trip at OCOcean.com.
Welcome back. The 2022 midterms are about to officially wrap up with Raphael Warnock and Herschel Walker squaring off in a Senate runoff election tomorrow. Both candidates were on the campaign trail today, with the incumbent Warnock speaking to voters in the Atlanta area, while Walker stumped for votes in more rural areas of the state. Nearly 2 million Georgians have already voted early. In fact, more than 76,000 Georgians have voted in the runoff that didn't vote in the general. That's according to Georgia Votes, a website that uses public data to analyze voting trends. NBC's Steve Kornacki has a closer look at what both candidates have to do to win tomorrow.
All right, Kristen. Well, one of the key things I think that jumped out from the November general election that's going to be crucial for this runoff tomorrow here was the gap between how Herschel Walker did, you see, finishing behind Warnock by about a point, and how basically every other Republican running statewide in Georgia did, most notably in the governor's race. Brian Kemp, the Republican, won easily in the governor's race, got 53.5% of the vote. Republicans won the other statewide offices in Georgia. Walker was the exception. He ran, you see, 53.5% for Kemp. Walker, 48.5%. He ran 5 points behind Governor Kemp here. So that's the key question, I think, in terms of Walker. If he's going to overtake Warnock and win this, what he needs is those voters, those Republican-friendly voters who were there in November for every Republican except him. He needs them to turn out, and he needs them to vote for him this time. So where are we going to be looking in particular to see if that's happening? There are a bunch of counties here in the Atlanta metro area, maybe kind of on the fringes of it, like Cherokee County. This is the single biggest Republican plurality producing county in Georgia. You see, look, hey, Walker won it by 38 points. You say that's pretty good, right? Well, it is, except if you compare it to how Brian Kemp did in the same county. Kemp won Cherokee by 50 points. You know, similar story next door, Forsyth County. Kemp wins it by 46 points. You take a look at the Senate race, Walker wins it, but only by 32. So that's one of the questions. Walker doesn't need to be getting Kemp levels exactly in these counties, because Kemp had a pad there. He won by 8 points. But Walker needs to get closer to what Kemp got in places like Cherokee and Forsyth County. So we'll be looking at those areas to see if he's winning over those Republican voters who were for every Republican except for him in November. On the Democratic side, obviously Democrats were generally happy. Warnock came within 20,000 or so votes of winning outright in November and not even needing the runoff campaign. But if there was one thing that worried Democrats coming out of November, black turnout relative to previous midterms appeared to be a little bit off, a little bit down in Georgia. So there's been an extra effort from Democrats here, certainly with the early vote, trying to increase black turnout. There's a bunch of counties kind of spanning the mid part of the state here with large black populations. We'll be keying in on those certainly as the results come in to see, is there a sign there that Democrats turned out more votes? Is Warnock a little stronger there than he was in the general election? That if there was some weakness for Democrats, that's where it was. So we'll be looking to see about that too, how that plays out, Kristen, tomorrow night.
All right, Steve Kornacki, I know you'll be tracking all of it for us. Thank you for that. Joining me now from Atlanta is NBC News correspondent Vaughn Hilliard. So, Vaughn, it is truly the home stretch of the home stretch. How are each campaign feeling?
Right. Both campaigns are out on the campaign trail. Look, just 38,000 votes separated the two candidates just 1 month ago. So there's every reason to believe that when you're crunching the numbers that we're going to have at least a somewhat tight race again. And that's why the turnout for tomorrow is going to be so crucial. There were 1.5 million folks, Kristen, that on the Tuesday of the general election turned out to vote. And so the question is, how many come out tomorrow? You can look at the weather. And I was just talking to our photog Derek about this here in Georgia. It's something like 40 degrees and raining. We're expecting the same thing tomorrow. This is not Ohio or Pennsylvania. This is not normal. To what extent does it impact turnout? You know, for Herschel Walker, we're talking about somebody who needs to turn out, as Steve was just laying out, some of those more hesitant conservatives or independent voters here. So, you know, this is the difficulty of, you know, of waiting for election day to roll around. But you have both men on the campaign trail. Herschel Walker heavily focusing on the more rural counties, trying to drive out the conservative vote. And then you have the likes of Raphael Warnock, who has multiple events around the greater metropolitan Atlanta area today with likes of John Ossoff and Killer Mike, Kristen.
Well, and of course, you have been all over it, and you got this exclusive interview with the ex-girlfriend of Herschel Walker, who is speaking out, accusing him of abuse during their relationship. It was a great get, Vaughn. Talk to us about what she is telling you and why she's speaking out now. It has a lot of people scratching their heads so close to Election Day.
Right. I think the preface, if I made all of this, Kristen, is the fact that Herschel Walker has been plagued by allegations from numerous individuals over the course of this last year since becoming a Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate. Multiple women have come forward to claim that he paid for them to have abortions. There were three children who Herschel Walker now acknowledges publicly that were not initially disclosed to the public. And now you have the likes of Cheryl Parsa, who flew out to Texas and interviewed her yesterday. She was a former partner of 5 years. I want to let you listen to some of her account and what she told us. Take a listen.
He was speaking with such force that his saliva was all over my face. And he had his hand on my throat and my chest. And then he leaned back to throw a punch. And luckily I was able to avoid that. And the punch landed on the wall instead of me.
This is a candidate who has been plagued by allegations. Of course, his own son 2 months ago alleged that his father threatened to kill his family. And back in 2008, Walker's ex-wife, Cindy Grossman, alleged that Herschel Walker held a gun to her head and threatened to kill her on the spot there. This is a difficult closing message, you know, that Herschel Walker is having to counter right now.
Kristen? Yeah, it sure is. And as you rightfully point out, these are the types of allegations that have plagued his campaign. Von Hilliard, great reporting. Thank you so much. Well, coming up, we'll have more on Georgia Senate runoff, what the results of the last race in 2022 could mean for 2024, and the latest fallout from Mr. Trump's controversy, including Ambassador John Bolton's announcement just moments ago that he is absolutely considering a 2024 run in order to stop former President Trump. The panel is next. You're watching Meet the Press Now.
I think every one of them, before they declare their candidacy, should say Donald Trump was wrong, we repudiate him, he doesn't belong in the Republican Party. And honestly, if they don't, there's one thing that would get me to get into the presidential race, which I look at in prior elections, it would be to make it clear to the people of this country that Donald Trump is unacceptable as the Republican nominee.
That was some news. You heard it here. Former Trump National Security Advisor John Bolton just moments ago on this show calling on the rest of the potential 2024 Republican field to denounce Donald Trump's candidacy while also opening the door for a run of his own. At this hour, we're hearing from more elected Republicans on the former president's comments. According to Politico, Senate Republican number 2, John Thune, says he disagrees with Mr. Trump's comments, but he dodged the issue of whether he'd withhold support for Mr. Trump if he's the Republican nominee in 2024, saying that it's a long way off. Meanwhile, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell told reporters on Capitol Hill that he will address the former president's remarks tomorrow. So we will look for that. But joining me now to discuss all of this, NBC News senior political editor Mark Murray, Democratic strategist and NBC political analyst Juanita Tolliver, and former Florida Republican congressman and NBC News political analyst Carlos Curbelo. Thanks to all of you for being here on a very busy Monday. Mark, I have to start with you. What is your reaction to what we just heard from Ambassador Bolton?
Well, I didn't have him on bingo card, John Bolton, getting in the 2024 presidential race. And Kristen, you know, it is interesting. If you go back to Labor Day and when we were kind of thinking about Republicans having very big gains, I think there was the possibility that a lot of political reporters and analysts were kind of staring at the possibility of we're looking at a Joe Biden versus Donald Trump race and not a lot of people in between. And to me, it shows you just how bad the midterms were for Republicans and particularly for those Donald Trump endorsed candidates on the fact that we're not even talking about Donald Trump versus Ron DeSantis and maybe Chris Christie and Nikki Haley and a bunch of other Republicans, even Republicans who ended up working for Donald Trump getting in, but also another person like John Bolton. And we do have to take a breath. We have a long way to go. Donald Trump decided to jump into this race at a very early juncture. But I think we are seeing kind of the dominoes falling from what was a really bad midterm election for a lot of Republicans.
I think it's such an important point, Carlos, this idea that what we learned in the midterms is that former President Trump is in some ways politically not as strong as he was immediately when he left office. What do you make of what you heard from Ambassador Bolton today?
Well, I think he falls into the category of Republicans who are looking to run for office or at least get on TV and talk about these things in order to expose Donald Trump and to highlight, right, how dangerous Trump was, how erratic he was, and the risks that he posed while he was president and that he could pose in a second presidency. So he's there with Liz Cheney, obviously. We'll see what she decides to do. And to a lesser degree with Mike Pence. If you listen to Mike Pence carefully, he's saying these things. He's just not as forward about it. But these are people who their only purpose, it seems, is to get into this race or get into the political arena to talk about how dangerous Donald Trump is.
Juanita.
And the other thing that Bolton mentioned that I'm zooming in on is the fact that Trump's power over the GOP is lowering. It's decreasing. Mm-hmm. You mentioned 30% of the base says they are more Trump supporters than Republican supporters. And I'm like, that's way down from 43% just earlier this right. year. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is something that I think other Republicans should be paying attention to, saying like, hey, it's worth taking a shot.
I want to get you guys to weigh in on something I asked Ambassador Bolton, which is what we saw in 2016, which is this splintering of the Republican field. You do have a number of Republicans who've expressed interest in potentially getting into this race. Carlos, could this wind up ultimately emboldening former President Trump?
Yeah, for other Republicans, the fact that Trump is weak is a double-edged sword because right. it invites a lot of people into the race. Now, the question is, can Republicans be disciplined? Democrats, you know, as soon as Joe Biden kind of emerged, they all ran for the exits and they let him consolidate support and really get strong before the general election. Will Republicans, will it be enough of a priority to stop Donald Trump to say, okay, there's one who's clearly ahead of the field, let's him or her take this and the rest of us will take a step back.
Mark.
Yeah, the miscalculation that so many people ended up making in 2016, whether it was Republicans running for president, the Hillary Clinton campaign, a lot of people in the news media, was that Donald Trump couldn't win.
Right.
And
right.
I do think that the lesson from 2016, when we go into 2024, and even if it's like a size of 10 Republicans who are running against Donald Trump, it's 15. I don't think there will be the mistake that he can't win even with just a plurality of the vote.
Yeah. And also, in addition to not only the thought that the wrong thought that Trump couldn't win in 16, but that he was just saying things. It was just words. Mm-hmm. He has acted on those words repeatedly over the last 6 years.
I'm glad you bring that up because it takes me to my next point. Jen Psaki, former White House press secretary, said on Meet the Press over the weekend that you underestimate Trump at your own peril.
Right.
Juanita, do you think that Democrats are at risk of doing that in this moment where you have former President Trump, you know, with controversy after controversy already? And yet, he still does galvanize a fair amount of the Republican base.
I'm shaking my head no, because Democrats, their closing message was about the continued threat that Trump and MAGA Republicans present to our country, our basic pillars of our democracy. And that is a through line that we're already seeing being continued from the White House. Their statement today, calling on other Republicans to condemn Trump, calling on other Republicans to speak out against his statement about getting rid of the Constitution, that shows that they are front and center thinking about how Trump is a critical part of yeah. this election.
It's also clear, Juanita, though, that the more prominent Donald Trump is, the better politically for the Democratic Party.
Part.
So I think it is important to denounce Trump and to call Republicans to denounce Trump. But we also know that Democrats do have an interest in keeping Trump in the news because clearly when he's in the news, they win elections.
I want to move on to Georgia, but before we do, very quickly, I just want your take on this. Is this moment different, Mark? I asked Ambassador Bolton this, but does this feel like a different moment for the former president when it comes to Republicans increasingly speaking out? Yes, we have not heard from McConnell and McCarthy yet. I anticipate we will in some form this week, but Republicans are denouncing him more loudly than they have in the past.
Yeah, what to me is different is that now we've seen repeated and multiple where Donald Trump and his candidates have ended up losing. You know, even after he ended up losing in the 2020 election, said, oh, it was just stolen from me. And he was able to at least get people to not pay attention as much as maybe people normally would have after his defeat. I do think these midterm results only magnify the situation that here was somebody who lost the House of Representatives in 2018, lost the presidency in 2020, lost the Senate in 2021, and oh, by the way, underperformed in a midterm election, which was supposed to hurt the Democrats. I think you add all that up, and that's what's different.
And still, Mark, so many Republicans are so careful about walking away from Trump. So it shows you the power of this Trump trap, where they know what the right thing to do is, but they will only walk in that direction very slowly.
One place we're not seeing former President Trump is in Georgia. Juanita, what's your take in these closing hours of this runoff race?
It's clear that he is a drag on the GOP, and Herschel Walker's team knows that. They don't even want him there. I do think that the momentum, of course, is fully on Senator Warnock's side at this point. When you talk about the surrogates game that Senator Warnock has compared to Herschel Walker, Warnock is knocking it out of the park, getting that GOTV campaign to ultimately have organizers bend over backwards to jump over the voter suppression bills that we've seen come from the Republican state legislature there. But Trump, I think at most he's doing a teletown hall tonight. That's the most he's been allowed in the state.
Yeah, fittingly, the two things that Republicans are dealing with in this last election of this cycle is what Mitch McConnell said, candidate quality. Herschel Walker is a very, very weak, troubled candidate. And the Trump effect, both are probably going to give Democrats yet another win this cycle.
Mark, you've been watching this race so closely and obviously past races in Georgia. How big of a deal is the interview by Arvon Hilliard, these allegations to come out in the 11th hour of the campaign? And I put it into this broader context. They are consistent with a broader range of allegations that the Walker campaign has been dealing with all.
Yeah, and whether it was Vaughn interview, your own interview, Kristen, I do think that voters in Georgia have perfect information about both candidates. It's sometimes where people end up saying, he's like, only if I actually knew about X, Y, or
it
Z. And with hundreds of millions of ads, I think Georgians had the full picture on both candidates. I will end up saying, looking back at past runoffs in Georgia, the party that just had the really good election result has often traditionally fared poorly in these runoffs. And part of it is, like, after you have a good cycle, you take your foot off the gas. One exception to that was in 2021 when you end up seeing John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock win after Democrats won the presidency. Now, a lot of that was helped by Donald Trump's own intervention into the aftermath of that 2020 election. But one thing is, I feel like Warnock is in the position of strength. But I think, to me, the biggest question is, did Democrats still have their foot on the gas or did they take it off? And you made me that's what I'm going to be looking at. That is the one
question.
Way where Walker does win, but somehow they did take their foot off the
gas. Juanita, very quickly, if Warnock does not win, I mean, how devastating of a loss is that for Democrats because of, you know, you just said you think he has the momentum heading into that home stretch. I mean, how big of a defeat would that be?
It would be a huge defeat. I think it would also be a reminder of what the Georgia electorate thinks they need to represent them. Like, if the voters of Georgia send Herschel Walker, who was incapable and incompetent of being a U.S. senator, to the U.S. Senate only to be told what to do by the Republicans around him, whether that's Lindsey Graham, whether that's McConnell, like, he will just do whatever they say. And it's at their loss. It's at their detriment if that's what happens.
Okay, that has to be the final word. We're out of time. Thank you. Great panel, everyone. Mark, Juanita, and Carlos, appreciate it. Coming up next, the uncertain situation in Iran after a government official claims the country's morality police is being disbanded after weeks of mass protests. But first, as we mark 75 years of Meet the Press, here's a key moment from our archives. Then President Jimmy Carter talking about the Iran hostage crisis in 1980.
Mr. President, is there any specific new hope for ending the hostage crisis with Iran?
I can't predict the early end of that situation. The concern that I feel about the hostages today is just as great as it was a month ago or 2 months ago. Our policy on the Iranian capturing of our hostages has been clear and consistent. It's an abhorrent violation of every moral and ethical standard and international law. It's a criminal act. A group of terrorists, kidnappers seizing innocent victims and holding them for attempted blackmail in an unprecedented way, supported and encouraged by government officials themselves.
Welcome back. After months of protests in Iran this weekend, Iran's government-affiliated media reported the country's attorney general said the morality police will be, quote, abolished, and a review of the mandatory hijab law is underway. The Interior Ministry, which oversees the morality police, has not commented yet. Neither has the Supreme Leader of Iran. But Iran's morality police have not been visible in Tehran for weeks now. According to NBC News' team on the ground, it all comes as the most widespread protests seen in Iran in decades are now in their third month and amid calls for more strikes and protests this week. Meanwhile, the Biden administration is downplaying claims the controversial and feared morality police has been disbanded and is very skeptical around Iran will ease its restrictive dress code on women. I'm joined now by NBC News Tehran Bureau Chief Ali Arouzi. Ali, good to see you. Thank you for joining me. Can you tell us what the reaction has been by Iranians to what the attorney general said, particularly given that the attorney general doesn't oversee the morality police? How much credibility does he have?
Well, nobody really in the government in Iran has much credibility with the people on the street. Those sort of comments are falling on deaf ears amongst the protesters in Iran. Today on social media, you've seen there's been a lot of calls the last few days for protests and strikes to start today. And people have accused the attorney general and the regime in general of using this as a deflection tactic. So people will be, you know, put off coming to the protests or they won't strike. Maybe they'll be some compromise to be made with the government, but that wasn't the case whatsoever. They didn't believe anything they said, and in fact, the calls for protests and strikes even grew further after those comments were made yesterday. Mm. So Iranian people, the protesters on the street, are seeing this as their own doing. If the government is backing down or reviewing laws or looking at the morality police, they're saying this isn't them showing any leniency. This is the critical mass of people that came up onto the streets, particularly women, who refuse to wear the hijab. So now it's unenforceable. You walk around Tehran these days, Kristen, 60% of the women in Tehran and other major cities refuse to wear the hijab. So the authorities simply can't enforce one of the pillars of the revolution, and they're scrambling now.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was just talking to Ambassador Bolton, who said he sees this moment as one where the regime is on its heels because of these protests, that this may be a transformational moment in Iran. Is that your sense, Ali, or is this moment different than past moments of protest there?
It certainly feels different, Kristen. It feels, the wanton violence is like nothing I've ever seen. And the demands of the protesters are also like something I've never seen. A lot of people ask me, is all of this violence, all of these protests going to bring about any meaningful change? Well, Iran has already changed. You know, women are not wearing the headscarf, which they've been, you know, ruthlessly enforced for 43 years. There's graffiti all over the walls of Iran, you know, anti-regime graffiti. The municipality painted over the next day. It's back on the walls. At 9 o'clock every night, like clockwork, people open their windows and they start chanting anti-government slogans for a good hour. Things I've never heard before. So what's happening in Iran is like something I haven't seen before, but the trajectory isn't clear. The system is very deeply rooted, but the protesters are also very determined to make some meaningful change.
All right, Ali Arouzi. Well, we are always so grateful for your reporting and for your perspective. Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Still to come, the Supreme Court heard arguments today in a key case on the future of anti-discrimination laws and LGBTQ rights. Did the court tip its hand on which way it will rule? We'll have the very latest next. You're watching Meet the Press now. Welcome back. The Supreme Court heard arguments this morning in a case that could have a major impact on protections for the LGBTQ community and other vulnerable groups. The case was brought by Colorado web designer Lori Smith, who is seeking exemption to Colorado's LGBTQ anti-discrimination law. Now, Smith argues the law could force her to make a wedding website for a same-sex couple, something Smith says goes against her evangelical Christian beliefs and encroaches on her right to free speech. NBC News Washington correspondent Yamiche Alcindor joins me after the first day of arguments. Yamiche, thanks so much for being here. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Break down what we heard today in these arguments.
Well, as you said, this is really a consequential case, potentially focused on civil rights, LGBTQ gay rights, as well as free speech. And what we heard from Lori Smith's side was really this idea that no one should be able to be compelled in America to deal with speech and to have speech that they feel like goes against their convictions. And in this case, it's her opposing same-sex marriage. But on the flip side, you have the state of Colorado saying essentially that this might be a license to discriminate. And they brought up the idea that Lori Smith could also be against disabled marriages or people of color, interracial marriages. There were some feisty back and forth in terms of oral arguments. Let's listen to what Justice Sonia Sotomayor had to say.
What's the limiting line of yours of yours. Justice Kagan asked you about another website designer, but how about people who don't believe in interracial marriage? Or about people who don't believe that disabled people should get married? Where's the line? I choose to serve whom I want if I disagree with their personal characteristics like race or disability?
And civil rights groups are saying that there really isn't a clear line. This could be a slippery slope. You could have people who say, my restaurant is artistic expression and I don't want to have African-Americans there because that's against my religious beliefs. So a big case to definitely watch.
Let me follow up with you very quickly. What are the broader implications when you think about civil rights, when you think about anti-discrimination lawsuits? I mean, are there other potential lawsuits in the wings and other cases that could be brought before the court?
Court watchers, and especially civil rights activists, say that this is really could have big implications going down the line, that people could say, my religious beliefs say, as what we were saying, that race comes into this, that people could say, I don't like people who are of a different faith than me. There was an argument being made about whether or not Christian stores and Christmas stores might say, well, I want to serve only Christians and not Jews. So there are a lot of big questions here, especially during this political time where we are, of course, talking about anti-Semitism and racism and LGBTQ rights. So a big case, and I think the consequences of it and the implications of it are going to be big when there is a decision.
Yeah, and I think you're right to point out the backdrop, that there is certainly a broader backdrop that all of this is being discussed against. Yamiche Alcindor, thanks so much for all of your great reporting from the Supreme Court. We really appreciate it. And thank you for being with us this hour. I'll be back tomorrow with more Meet the Press Now.
Swing into Seaside Golf in Ocean City, Maryland. Play like a pro at 17 championship courses designed by golf legends like Jack Nicklaus and Arthur Hills. Tee off on sweeping vistas at Eagle's Landing. Savor the coastal views of Lighthouse Sound. Or see why Ocean City Golf Club is considered one of the Mid-Atlantic's finest fairways. Whether you're sneaking in a quick round on a family vacation or going all in on a golf getaway, fun is always in play at Ocean City, Maryland. Plan your trip at OCOcean.com.